Hi, it's a Sunday later in the afternoon, and I don't have anybody yet for this week for the Haftorah for the history podcast, but let me say something from Mishpachas Stefanski. Since I came across it, I reminded myself of something I haven't seen in a long time, and we're now into 3 weeks, and Tisha B'Av's around the corner, and one of the things that we all know that you're going to have the kinos on Tisha B'Av, that the Ashkenazi Jews, anyway, have for the Crusades. So the Crusades of 1096, Tatnu, happened in, you know, I guess May, June, July, that sort of thing in the year 1096. And then they went away, and they left a train wreck. And when you read the four or five kinos on Tisha B'Av, and anybody's ever listened to them, you know, usually we record them and put them online, I do the kinos each year, so I always pay special attention to the kinos on Tisha B'Av, because the Crusader ones, because they have a different character than the other kinos. Reason is because it's eyewitness account. When you read the regular kinos or slichos, that sort of thing, so they're pretty in a certain way, but they're artificial in another way, and that's because the authors of these piyutim, slichos, kinos, shamtas, all the different technical terms for the different sorts of poetry, religious poetry, they weren't there. They didn't see anything. They're writing hundreds of years later. You understand? So, like Rabbi Elazar Kalir, we all know is the great Paitan. He wasn't there at the time of the Beis HaMikdash. He's writing hundreds of years later. Not that long afterwards, but nevertheless hundreds of years later. So he wasn't there when the Roman army stormed Jerusalem and all that stuff. So all he has to go by, the Kaliri, I'm saying, are, you know, the Chazals, which he's very good at. So, you know, the Gemara Kamsa Bar Kamsa, for example, and he has all these, you know, arcane allusions that the poetry readers like to pick apart, and the Midrashim, the Medrashecha, and things like that. So there are classical sources. However, being that they're from rabbinic literature, they have a stylized form. They don't usually tell exactly the way things work. They do it for a point. And usually the point has something to do with some kind of mussar. Either positive mussar or negative mussar. Anybody's ever read, I mean, all you need to do is the Kamsa Bar Kamsa thing in Agadah and Gittin, which I'm sure most people listening to this have heard of and probably seen. But even more so, if you look in the Medrash Rabbah and Eicha, same idea. The sins of the Jewish people caused it. The enemy was very merciless. Tisha B'Av, you know, they bashed babies' heads against the rocks. All that kind of business. And that's what ends up in the kinos of Blessed Kaliri, which is many of them, as you know. So it's what you call a sacred history, a stylized history. And you could do it too. I could do it too. Now, we're not in the same league of Kaliri, obviously. But I'm just saying, if I had any talent and I know the sources, so I can put together a kino also. You know what I'm saying? If I had talent. I don't, but I'm just saying if I did. Because the material is kind of there. La Fuki, as opposed to the five or so piyutim, or kinos, I should say, from the Crusades, which are not that way at all, but they're clearly written by survivors. So the basic idea is the kind of thing you read from the few piyutim or kinos that have emerged from the Holocaust is a big difference if you read something from, let's say, for example, Weissmandl, who was there, although he was not in the camp. Now, I'm not making light of what he went through. I know what he went through. And a terrible thing. I mean, I know that. My mother's from in that part of the world. But nevertheless, if you see a kina from somebody who lived through Auschwitz or Dachau or something like that, who lived through the ghettos, who experienced the type of things you read about in Ushri, you know, Mima Makim and all that kind of business, that has, and if a person had talent and wrote a kina like that, then it would be very different then if you read the thing from Rabbi Schwab or otherwise. Now, I'm not putting down Rabbi Schwab. He's a great man. But he wasn't, luckily for him, he was in Baltimore, Maryland during the Holocaust, not over there. So we Americans all know what happened over there in a historical way, the gas chambers and the concentration camps and the experiments that they did and this and that and the other, and they all appear in his kina, that I'm sure has been very widespread now. But, you know, it rhymes too nicely. It fits everything great. It's very stylized, very rabbinic in style. That's just the way this kind of literature goes. But if you do the ones in the keynotes, then you see the dead bodies lying over the place, and especially the poet complaining to God, how come you didn't interfere? How come you didn't intervene? Which is an old line that you find in the Tanakh as well. You find Nevi'im here and there complaining, Rabbanu Shalom, where are you? Why are you asleep at the switch? Torei nai mi'atzes ra, v'habed el oma lo yucho, lo masabi bogdim, machrish, kabbalah rasha, tzadik mimino. I happen to remember that pasuk in Habakkuk. Don't ask me why. But the prophet is saying, how come you turn a blind eye to the suffering over here? You understand? Torei nai, you're so beautiful, perfect, and you can't see any evil, but there's so much evil that goes on in the world. And this, of course, is the difference between somebody who actually is a survivor and went through it versus a rabbi or something like that who heard about it but wants to write in a firm way. I get that. Okay? And as I say before, you'll find in the kinos from the Crusades, number one, horrific descriptions of the parents slaughtering the children and so forth and so on, the Jews I'm talking about. Because, you know, they all did mass suicide. You know, I'm not telling you what you don't know. And number two, the anger, how come Hashem doesn't do anything about it? And number three, a call for vengeance. Kiyom nakom libi. I want to see justice. Here we are, I'm saying this podcast in the week of, first of all, in the 3 weeks, and second of all, Parshas Matas Masei and Tavshim Pehei. So Matas is... Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Nekom nikmas b'nei Yisrael meis ha-midyonim. Right? So the Jewish people are very angry, or at least they should be angry, and Hashem says, take Nekom on them. So you can't say, you know, it's an unworthy sort of thing. And you find in other places, you know, Nekom yashol l'tzarov. We have such a way. Actually, in Davar Rachamim, do you say every Shabbos? It says, Yinkom dam abadech ha-shavuch. So you call for a certain vengeance. And I remember that Steve and others say, you know, they point to Hillel, where King David says, I've forgotten which psalm, but in the 50s, Yichsmach tzadik yichaza nokam pa'omav yirchatz b'damar rasha. Again, I happen to remember that pasuk. The righteous man will rejoice when he sees nekama, and he will bathe his feet in the blood of the wicked. Woo. But don't say, whoa, I'm living in Baltimore, Bachlino, Sarah Busser, you know, so nothing's wrong here, meanwhile. But if somebody went through Dachau, or went through Auschwitz or Treblinka or one of those things, or anything along those lines, you can totally hear this, right? Totally hear this. I don't know what's going on in the minds of the Chatufim in Israel that were liberated, and what exactly they went through and how they feel about it. But I'm sure some of them, if they're not totally freaked out yet, are praying, you know, bring the Kama down on all these Hamas people and stuff like that. And Israel certainly as a nation feels that. And the reason I say it is because every time they take out a guy who participated in October 7th, it's in the news. You see it all the time. They took out Muhammad this and that, Abu this and that, and he was on October 7th. You understand? So the call for the Kama is 100% understandable, even though, you know, according to modern liberal teachings, it's a teachable moment. You shouldn't go for turn the other cheek and so on and so forth. But that's not what the Torah says, right? How's it saying, Hazinu, Kidam Abadav Yikom, Menachem Yashula, Harninu Goyim Amo, Kidam Abadav Yikom? Moshe Rabbeinu says in Hazinu, Harninu Goyim Amo, that the Jewish people rejoice when they see the Nekama. It's just interesting. Now, you're not supposed to take Nekama Yehudi mi Yehudi, but if you have somebody else who hurts you, especially horrifically, like in the Holocaust or something like that, so don't be surprised you'll see this. Now, in the case of the Piyutim, the Ashkenazi Piyutim especially, but Sephardim also, rarely do you see, at least to my knowledge, I can only tell, like I say all the time, I only know what I know. I'm not the world's greatest expert in all of Hebrew poetry. I just know more than some. And when you survey Jewish poetry, they're very circumspect about the Nekama part. Because I guess they're afraid of the people in whose midst they lived. And you can sort of see it obliquely, maybe. Once in a while, you know, it's very rarely direct. Okay? Kill these momsers because of what they did to us. And so on and so forth. But there are exceptions. And my attention was drawn, I haven't seen this in years, to a famous piet, not long, or famous poem, which is like, whoa, sulfur and, Guffrey's from Melach. From Rashi, it's called Titnaim Lecherpa. It's not so long. The Marshal has a tshuva, and the tshuva is Marshal, in which he gives a lot of the history of the Ashkenazim, because he claims, I mean, correctly, he's descended from the Ashkenazim. He goes rabbi through rabbi, generation after generation. If you're a person interested in nitty-gritty details of the Ashkenaz stuff, a locus classic is tshuva responsum number 29 in the Marshal. And, you know, if you're interested, take a look. And he mentions over there that Rashi composed, among other things, a number of piyutim. That's fairly well known. I'm sure I've done two or three of them over the course of my podcast experience. I remember the one from Tzom Gedalia. I know I did. There's a couple others. But there's one that is like, whoa, over the top in calling for curses and the Kama and this and that and the other, which clearly was composed after Tatnu, after the Crusades of 1096. Now, you have to understand, Rashi is an Ashkenaz Jew, that's true. And by the way, the reason I'm taking this over today is I have to do now these, I'm doing a lecture series in Baltimore on Jews and assimilation. And I had to, tomorrow night is about the Christian Middle Ages. And my mind was wandering over the Middle Ages. And I looked up, I reread some stuff over Shabbos. There's a very nice bio of Rashi by Professor Grossman. That's the best one in English, by far. The others are much more inferior. And by Professor Grossman, because he eats and breathes this stuff. You know, he's what he calls, he's definitely the man who's into Chachmei Ashkenaz Betzarfas and Chachmei Ashkenaz Be'Ashkenaz. So if you look at the map of Europe, you'll, especially in the 11th century when Rashi lived, you'll see, but even today, there was a thing called the Kingdom of France, and next to it was the Holy Roman Empire, which was Germany. So just like today, France and Germany were side by side. The borders were somewhat different. And the reason I'm mentioning this is, Rashi lived in the county of Champagne, which is southeast of Paris, if you know where that is. It's on the Seine River. And Paris is also on the Seine River. So if you could actually travel by boat from Paris to the town where Rashi lived. Maybe one day, one of my trips, maybe I'll do something like that. We're thinking of putting together a trip next year. So what happened 1096 was that the Crusaders went down through the Rhine Valley and they happened not to go into France. Okay? In other words, because France was the next country over. So this is just a feature of the history of Klal Yisrael, which is, and it's a strange feature, and that's where you see Hashgacha Pratis. And by that I mean, whenever there's been some terrible persecution or killing of the Jews, there's a certain place where it happens and a certain place where it doesn't happen. And who can figure out how God organized matters that happened over here and didn't happen over there? Even in World War II, and I've made this point many times, there are certain spots in Europe where if you were Jewish, you were safe. I mean, the continent of Europe. And other places not. So off the top of my head, if you lived in Switzerland, which is in the belly button of Europe, right next door to Germany and all that, surrounded by Germany actually during World War II, nothing happened to the Jews there. That's why you get the art scroll book on Mrs. Sternbuch, you know. You can see all that. And there was a yeshiva operating there. I think Rabbi Steinman, if I remember correctly, was there during the war. So a few miles away over the border, it's, Michutz Teshakel Ker v'chadar mima. Everybody's being killed by the Nazis. And then you cross the border into Germany and not. As a matter of fact, within the history of World War II, and again, I've made this point, it depends when and where. For example, if you lived in Hungary, you were not deported until March of 44. So a person could be in yeshiva. I'm very serious about this. In 1940, 41, 42, 43, into 44. And there were such things. And right next door in Poland, they had an idea of some way or the other. It's killing 3 million people in Auschwitz and Treblinka and places like that. 3 million. So it's weird. Over here is nothing, and over there is something. And there are many accounts. I remember Elie Wiesel wrote this, but not only him, that the Hungarian Jews didn't believe that this is coming. I believe there's a new series, new set from, what's her name? That lady, professor, the Frum lady, escapes me, that she's doing on Holocaust things in Eretz Yisrael. I think her husband's Rosh Yeshiva. Farbstein, that's it. Professor Farbstein. She did one on the Holocaust in Hungary, in English. You can get it, look it up online if it interests you. And it's weird, because until March of 44, everything was fine. Now, the Jews had certain persecution over there, but compared to Hitler, persecution is nothing. And then it came and everybody got killed, or many, many, many got killed, as you know, in Hungary. Midukisa, and again, it's weird. The Holocaust never hit Romania exactly. In a weird way, I mean, it did in a certain place, but for Rova, Romania, it didn't. And so if you lived in Bucharest, you kind of survived to the end of the war. You never knew, and for any minute, there was a great danger. And I'm sure people with any common sense didn't sleep at night. But Lamai said that's what happened. And in Bulgaria. But on the other hand, remember Hitler gave a finger. I've made this point many times. You look at the map of Hungary and Romania in 1943 and 44, for example. You can Google a map like that. And you'll see that Hitler awarded Hungary a finger into Romania because of a Hungarian population. And that means that if you lived in that finger, which includes Satmar and Kloisenburg, by the way, you were in the Holocaust and you got murdered by Hitler. And he did. But if you lived a few miles away, north or south, in the country called Romania, the Germans didn't come for you. So it's strange how this happens. So Rashi had this experience. He lived in France, not too far away from where the trouble was happening, but it never happened to hit him. On the other hand, all the people that were killed were people he knew, relatives, correspondents. Rabbanim he dealt with, his yeshiva buddies, because Rashi learned for a while in yeshiva and kolel, so to speak. Rashi left kolel because the money ran out. That's the story with Rashi. It's interesting. And he was in Worms and in Mainz, and that's where the Ashkenazic yeshivas were. But then he moved back to France, and I don't know if he ever visited there. I think he visited it once again, but lived his life in France. But he knew what happened, and we knew what a terrible Holocaust it was of the 1096. And in the aftermath, we have a fair amount of information from Rashi, including, by the way, the famous thing that Rashi says, don't throw it back in the face of the Bali Tshuva, because a lot of Jews didn't commit suicide but converted because of the Crusades. And then afterwards, they came back to Judaism, because the German government, by the way, allowed them to do that, unlike in Spain. That's a whole story by itself. I have a series on this on YouTube if you're interested in the details. You'll come to YouTube, the Crusades. I did it many years ago in detail. And that created a whole mess, because consider, for example, you're living in a town like Worms or Mainz or Speyer or one of these other places, Metz, that was hit by the Crusaders, that they came through like a storm. And let's say, for example, there are five Jews on the block, and four of them committed suicide rather than convert to Christianity. And one guy took the easy way out and converted, him and his family. And then, when the Crusaders left, because they left after a while, and things went back to normal, this guy was permitted by the Germans to go back to being Jewish. And now you come to the synagogue in the city. And guess what? All the Mizrachvant, all the seats and so forth are now empty because the people committed suicide. And there's probably a minion or two of people surviving who are the shmos, the ones who were cowards, who converted, who baptized, but under fear. And now they're coming back. And now they want to sit in the Mizrach seat. And this one wants to get an aliyah and all the rest of it. And the relatives surviving of the massacred ones say, how dare you do this? And my husband gave his life and you're a shmo and you're a coward. and you shouldn't be have any right. We shouldn't even count you for a minion. I can understand those feelings, very much so. But Rashi famously said, don't do that. Now, he's copying Rabbeinu Gershom. Apparently, there was some kind of a thing in the time of Rabbeinu Gershom also. We don't know that much about it, but there was some kind of a persecution. And the exact same thing happened. And the question was, you know, how do you treat somebody as a Meshumad and all that business? That's the whole discussion, a separate podcast. I don't want to go into now. Because the Ashkenazim, you know, actually created a reconversion ceremony. Once you shave off, you're going to mikvah, this, that, and the other. Which you and I know, I'll be din, you don't need. At least that's how we come out. And Rashi is very famous as being part of that. But I don't want to get pulled in that direction. But rather, I want to share with you this poem which Rashi composed, according to Marshall, but Rashi composed after this. He is so angry at the Christians, at the Crusaders, at all these Goyim. And Rashi, we know, had a lot of friends that were not Jewish. If you read not the Rashi Pirush on the Chumash or in the Gemara, but you read what they call Sifra Debei Rashi, Sefer Ora, these other things that have like Shalos and Tshuvos and letters and stuff like that from Rashi and a Machzer Vitri. Those who know, you find a lot of personal information there about the guy named Rashi, who to most of us is a cipher because you just know the guy who wrote the thing on the Chumash and the guy who wrote the thing on the Gemara, which is, of course, his main importance. But for a historian, like, who was, you know, the old line, who was it said this? Hildesheimer, somebody said, if you want to know what Rashi, had for breakfast, go to Gretz, you know, to the conservative. If you want to know Rashi, come to me. All right, I get that. I hear that. But on the other hand, people are also interested in what Rashi had for breakfast, if you know. See, did Rashi like red or white? I mean, if you know. It's just, that's a modern historical sensibility. So, anyway, so Rashi composed this poem, which wasn't published, for obvious reasons, for many centuries. And I think until the 20th century, 19th century, in which he calls down all the imprecations and curses in the world on these people. Now, as I was saying, he had friends because there's a fair number of shalos and all this. What if somebody's not Jewish, brings you a present on Yontif and happened to Rashi, and he brought him stuff on Pesach, and other times they did favors to him, and this and that and the other. So you see, Rashi was the type of person, whatever his business was, we don't know what his business was, but he had to make a living. He dealt with people who were not Jewish, and he had good relations with them. Ad kedei kach that they want to give him presents. So that bespeaks the fact that he was a very diplomatic type guy. And shine, right? The Rambam also had good relations, cultivated good relations. So did Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. You know, smart people do that. So, but here, he lets it all hang out. And the name of this fairly short poem, they call it a Shamto, which means I call for your destruction, your korban. It's a certain style. And it's called Titnaim L'Cherpa. Now, it's all based on oh. Just listen to this. Titnaim L'Cherpa L'Klolo L'Shama Tatich Aleim Af Shetzef Ketzef Echema Teshalach Ba Malachim Me'ero Megeres Me'uma Tashmidim B'Shikol Cherev Mechutz Mechadorim Ema Tirdim B'Ferech L'Mashkes Eva Solom Mestema Tarek Arkareim Cherev Lo Sechai Kol Neshama. Whoa! Tiksev Aleim B'Chema Shvucha B'Shat Nefesh Linkam Nekoma Tikra Aleim Kol Shofar Chazak Usruas Mokoma Tetzikim B'Matsar V'Matsok V'Ho'er V'Hashmed Ad Chorma Tatsivim Sela Ad Chorvas Chorib Shmama Tifkar Aleim Kol B'Charbacha Hakosha Chazak V'Aroma. What is over here? Kis Chorigam. One second. Tifna Aleim Levala Lahashkis Labi Zichram Hema Toir Aleim Kinas Chamas Geber Kerpa Kolor Klima To Akir Shar Sham Betomis Gizam Shorish Manav Vromi Hakoma To Salaf Daitam Besakam Atsosam To Abid Mehem Chochma To Tasich Besam Betosir Tzimon Mashis Tirosam Neshama To Nagafem Bahamik Basar Unabagruach Kishlon Berech Berifion Yad Besafa Neloma To Damfem Kind of Oshan Vimis Kadonach Mapolis Netzach Bain Tekuma. Now I'll translate for you. I think you get the idea. First I rely on the people who know Hebrew and then I'll translate. And this is from Rashi. And he's talking about his fellow, you know, the people in his time. And it's right after the Crusades. And what do you do to these mamzers?
And he says, "Tidneim lecherpa leklol shama, give them over to shame and curse and destruction. Tatekalimach, pour in them your wrath, shetzav kesev echema, the kind of heavy murderous wrath that you find in the Chumash. Tishalach ba malchim eira, send them angels with imprecations of megiras and mahuma. Tashmidim b'shikol cherub, michutz mechar darmeim." That's from Hazinu, right? And notice, let them feel what it's like to have the sword swinging outside and in the, and be terrified on the inside, like we went through. Tiradim eferech, crush them with heavy labor, lamashches, till it destroys them. Eba solam mastema, tarakachreim cherev, lo sechai kol neshama. See, he's calling for lo sechai kol neshama. He says, exterminate them, no prisoners. Lo sechai kol neshama. That's pretty heavy. I'm surprised to tell you the truth that he wrote this down and you didn't get into trouble. Tiksev aleim b'chema shvucha, be angry at them, poured out with outpoured wrath. B'shat nefesh linkom nekoma, with an easy, b'shat nefesh. In other words, without any compunctions, take nekoma. No, it's kill, 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 and have no conscience on it, because they don't deserve it. Tikra aleim kol shofar chazak, l'truas mechoma, announce the shofar as you attack. In the Middle East, this is Tuesday. What's going on in Syria now? But he's calling over here. Tetzikim b'matzor b'matzog, press them with a terrible siege. So in other words, and, you know, starvation, let them feel all that. V'har v'hashmid ha-karma, let them be destroyed until utter destruction. Tatzivim sa'ad charbis charb shmama, and let them end up with a complete korban. Difficult, I mean, he's using every Hebrew language, which the Marshal says, echa me'en lo shochach, the Rashi left nothing out. Tifkar alim kol b'karbacha akasha, let people hear the sound of your swords. Hachazako arama. Tifna alim levala hashchis lachem zirchema. Go after them to exterminate them. Lahashchis la'abed zirchem hema. So using the language of Haman. Okay? Lahashmis la'abed zirchem. Toyer alim kinis chamas gever kerpa kolar klimo. Let them have every kind of imprecation. Chamas, which is hatred. Chamas gever, kerpa, shame, kolar, servitude, klima, embarrassment, ta'aka shrosham. This again, a call for extermination. Abrut their shorish, as Lenin would say, pull them out by the roots. But Thomas gizom, and kill all their geza. So no, he's saying like this. This is pretty heavy. I don't simply want the crusaders that they should die. I want their children to die also. Why? Because that's what they did to us. They didn't just kill us, they killed our kids. And everybody else, the babies. So I want it for them. Shorish one of Rami Akoma. You know, those who were in the root, and even no matter how high ranking they are in society, to salaf daita, make them all mixed up. Besachat sasim tabmehim chachma. So in order for this to happen, pull down their defenses and make their chachma go away. Tisach besam, let their house be destroyed. Betaser tzilam, b'shis tiros neshama, and their shadow should disappear. Now the way you remove the shadow is if you kill everybody. Tin gefein b'hamik basar. Let them do the type of things where you see, like in the Tokacha. Notice, let them have starvation until their skin clings to their body. Unevoke ruach, and be bloated from the starvation. Kishlam berech, refion yod, and let their knees shake, like it says in the Tokacha, and their hands, v'safan eloma, and their lips be silenced. Tindefem kahomek kind of oshan. Scatter them like one does the smoke. Behimes, kadonag, mapolis, netzach, bein tekuma, and let there be an eternal mapolis, an eternal downfall, without any recovery. My goodness, this is the type of thing that you fits the Moshe Rabbeinu war in the Midian. But Rashi wrote it. Now, usually Rashi doesn't write like this. But under the circumstances, he did. And it's true that he wasn't there, but he was right nearby, and I'm sure that he met many of the survivors. That's, you know, I don't know that it's a historical fact, but it seems to me obvious. Rashi must have had personal contact with the survivors. I mean, physical, you know, contact, met them face-to-face, and certainly by correspondence. It hasn't all survived, but you can tell by his violent reaction over here, my goodness, that he's calling for, you know, like you say, the utter extermination of the evildoers. So this is simply, the reason I'm sharing this is a 3 weeks' work, you understand? This is something that takes you back long ago. And as I said over and over again, it's different between the ones who lived there and went through it and the ones who lived in another century and experienced it, you know, only through literary sources. And that's not the case with Rashi, at least not in this sort of thing. So when you read Rashi on Kamsa by Kamsa, he's commenting on a Talmudic story that he never saw. It happened long before he lived. But when you see over here, he's talking about something that, again, he didn't see personally because he was lucky enough to live nearby. But he knows exactly what happened. He knows exactly what happened. And a lot of them were his relatives and Rebbeim and old Chavrusas and that sort of thing. Anyway, I went a little bit longer than this. But as always, I want to thank Mishpachas Stefanski for allowing me to do this. And maybe we'll find somebody this week for the Haftorah and for the historical series. And with that, I wish you a good week.